you all to gather here today in this Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. For those of you that don't know, and those of you who do, we are a non-creedal community interested in helping individuals find their own unique ability to inquire into the world around them so that they may find the ability for faith in something sacred. We hope to create a space to ask the big questions such as, what do we love? What do we hold sacred? What calls to us? How do we aspire to live? These are big questions that we may never solve here on Sundays or in the whole of our life experiences. However, I hope this service today creates an opportunity for you to ask some of these questions of your own experiences of the world, and that this service gathers a community of seekers who will share that opportunity with you. I would like to welcome all of you who have chosen to spend this time here in our community. So, welcome. To begin our service, I will light our chalice. And I have a reading from Vandana Shiva. The food we eat, the food that nourishes us, is a gift from the earth, from the sun, from millions of years of evolution. It is also a gift from the farmers, livestock, herders, fish folk who till the land, care for the animals, and harvest the fish. When we forget the earth from where we receive our food, food becomes unsustainable. Food is life. Food is not just our vital need. It is the web of life. Food is alive. It is not just pieces of carbohydrates, protein, and nutrients. It is being. It is sacred being. Because food is the very basis of creation, food is creation. And it is the creator. It is divinity in the context of the way we live. There are all kinds of duties that we should be performing with respect to it. If people have food, it is because society has not forgotten those duties. If people are going hungry, society has moved away from the ethical duties related to food. So welcome. So our service begins with announcements. I didn't receive any before, but of course, turn to the inserts within the order of service. There are several events coming up. Pay attention to those and correspond with the correct people that have those opportunities. Now is time for our first opening hymn, number 6, Just As Long As I Have Breath. Thank you. This is the point we've reached a time in our service for joys and concerns. For those of you who are not aware of this practice, this is where we rise up as a community to revel in those experiences that you find meaningful and help uphold your strength when you have experiences that create hardship in your life. Go ahead, and if you have a joy or concern to share, raise your hand and we'll bring a mic around to you.
Hi, Larry Weaver. I had a first, let me say I've had a I have a lot of more traditionally religious friends. They use the word blessing a lot, and so I have a hard time with it. But I'd like to reclaim that word for our use because last night I had an experience that I can only call a blessing. I'd been to Kansas City to a singing party. We had sung for a couple of hours. We had eaten and drunk for an hour or so. And then a couple of guitars, several fiddles, piccolo, a flute, dulcimer, auto harp, guitars, banjos came out. And for 2+ hours, I was bathed in sound. It was wonderful. I received a blessing last night.
Michael Oldfather, and continuing on the subject of music, Slavomir Dobrzhansky, our pianist, when he's around and available, has slipped from his unwillingness to put things on YouTube. And he is going at it with something of a vengeance. And so I would recommend a lot of things that I have never heard and probably you have never heard are posted there, some that you have. Some of them are listed like by his initials. And his middle initial is P for Pavel, for Paul. Slavomir, so it's S-P-D. But it's worth the hunt to track them down because they're just wonderful, every single one of them.
We have...
I just wanted to share a joy that's kind of new and something that I've really been working toward for the last few years. And last week I submitted a proposal to the Green Action Fund at K-State for campus gardens. And so hopefully pretty soon we'll be able to produce food on some of the land on campus instead of just wasting a lot of energy and water and fertilizer to keep this cruddy grass doing whatever it's doing. So that's really exciting, and I'm just really hoping that all the permission goes through and we can get a little bit of funding. And I know there are a lot of local churches trying to start gardens and composting up. So I think this could be a really great year for just urban food production in Manhattan, Kansas. And I'm hoping to get a lot of people involved. Yeah, do you want to talk?
Yeah, I could talk about that one. Kind of on the same lines, the ECM, which is like a student ministry group, we did kind of on Friday, we had the first garden planning meeting, so the new building and the house next to it, we're going to be turning like the entire lawn into a garden with vegetables and fruit trees, and hopefully it'll turn out really well.
Very exciting. No one else has anything to share. Thank you for sharing your joys and concerns. Hopefully the community support. We can share in those joys and concerns and support you for those that were not shared as well. So now is time for our second hymn, hymn number 27, I'm the Great and Fiery Force.
Thank you.
the children would like to come forward, I have a story. Thank you. Are we good? Is the mic working? Sweet. So welcome. Wow, small group today. Hi. How are you all? Excellent. So, what's your favorite type of fruit? Yeah.
Strawberries.
What do you think? Pass. Anyone else want a favorite fruit? Apples. Perfect. You know, apples are, a lot of people really like apples, and you can find them all over the place, right? There's tons of them growing all over town, right? So what's your favorite type of apple? Yeah.
Green.
Green apples. What type of green apple? Do you know the name?
No.
Granny Smith? Not sure. Well, it's probably a Granny Smith or... Macintoshes are sometimes green, right? So, you don't know? Anyone else have a favorite type of apple? Yeah.
Red.
You like a red apple. There we go. So we have red and green apples, right? And there's a whole range of different red and green apples, though. What? And gold, right? And gold apples. And they're all different varieties of apples, right? So you have like a red delicious and a yellow delicious, and you have a Granny Smith and stuff. Do you know how they get those varieties to grow? How do you grow an apple tree? You buy or find a sprout? Where do the sprouts come from? Apple seeds. Well, did you know that apples aren't actually produced from seed, believe it or not? So they take roots from apple sprouts, right? And they take a branch off a tree that produces the fruit you want. So say Red Delicious, right? And you can't just put the seeds in the ground. And they take that branch and they graft it onto the root. And in grafting on the root, you guarantee that you get the fruit you want, right? So you can always get a Red Delicious if you graft a branch from a Red Delicious tree. Otherwise, if you put the seeds in the ground, the genetics are so crazy and variable, you would never have edible fruit if you just planted seeds. Did you know that? Kind of neat, huh? Well, who knows the story about some legendary figure that grows apples? Yeah? Johnny Appleseed. He's about apple seeds, right? He plants apple seeds in the ground. But if you plant apple seeds in the ground, you don't get the fruit you want, right? Did you know he actually... What? You might get bananas? Well, no, you're not going to get bananas. But, you know, with the apple trees, so Johnny Appleseed actually went along and planted the apples from seed. But he got all kinds of apple trees that you just can't eat the fruit on, or you can, but it's really hard to do so. You have to make, like, apple, you have to cook it or ferment it with yeast or go and do something else to make it flavorful, right? Well, you know why he planted them from seeds? Because he objected to cutting up live trees because of his kind of spiritual values. He was a part of a Christian community that didn't want to harm the animals, and he thought about or harm the plants because they were living beings, and it was part of his kind of practice, right? And so he objected to grafting, and he grew all kinds of different varieties, and that's part of the reason why we have so many varieties of like crabapple and other kinds of apples here in the United States. Even though they only sell a few in the stores. There's a problem there. But it's really, for him, his spiritual practice was nurturing life and growing it and making it happy and enjoying it, right? And so he grew tons of trees everywhere he went. Well, Reverend Holly later is going to be talking about how we respect where food comes from and making decisions like Johnny Appleseed about our spiritual practice and its relationship to food. So I thought I'd kind of share with you guys about apples and how, you know, one person really took apples to heart as their spiritual practice. Remember, the plants and animals that provide us food are... You know, part of what we respect as Unitarians, Universalists, right? Thinking about they're another form of life. They're part of kind of our system. And so you need to pay attention to that. So when we make choices about our food and how we grow, we make choices about the other living beings in our ecosystem. And I think that's just kind of an interesting lesson to learn from Johnny Appleseed. So I hope you guys go enjoy Ari and have a good day.
Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine our light in all you do. In love our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all.
So I understand today is a Helping Hands Day. So Betty Banner is going to present a little bit about the group we're helping this month, Peggy Bowman Second Chance Fund.
Good morning. Some of you have heard me talk about the Peggy Bowman Fund at other times, and some of you may not be familiar with it. The mission of this fund is to assist Kansas women who are in need of financial assistance to receive abortion services. In 2014, we financially assisted 254 women. Who do we help? Women who are pregnant and have determined, for whatever their personal reasons are, that the pregnancy needs to be terminated. They are low income and in need of financial assistance to get a procedure, and our residents of Kansas. We work through and with the clinics who provide abortion services, and you may be interested to know that our services are spread far and wide because sometimes women have to go much further than the boundaries of the state to receive services. There are three clinics in Oklahoma that we work with. There's one in New Mexico that provides late-term services. There's another that used to be in Nebraska but has had to move to Maryland in order to provide those services. And you may say, who needs them? Often those late-term abortions are for women who have had to make a wrenching decision in regard to a wanted child, but for whom we see serious fetal anomalies, a child who would not be able to survive if brought to birth. Sometimes people want to know, how much does it cost to get an abortion? And I think it's important to know that there are many costs above and beyond the actual cost of the procedure. It costs to travel to a clinic. In Kansas, there are three. Two in the Kansas City Overland Park area and one in Wichita. For our women who live in western Kansas, sometimes it's easier and more economical for them to travel to Colorado, for instance, to a clinic in Boulder that we often work with. There's also, in many states, including Kansas, a mandatory waiting period between the time a woman appears at the clinic and receives her legally mandated counseling and when the procedure can be performed. That means there's lodging and food costs. And what if, she has other children? Who's taking care of them while this happens? Or if she works at McDonald's or Burger King or some other fast food place that doesn't offer sick leave? How do you ask your job, your boss, for a time off to get an abortion? Can you schedule me for it? And the cost of the procedure itself. So those are the clinics, and we have made it known to those clinics that when a woman is from Kansas, they can contact our fund if she is financially needy to receive assistance from the fund. So that's what we do, and that's what your dollars do. This is a fund that is totally operated by volunteers. It covers the entire state. And probably 95% of the money that comes into the fund goes for procedures. There's a small amount that supports getting a newsletter out to our donors and friends, and creation of materials to make greater awareness of the fund and its services available. So I hope you can give generously to help these women who need assistance. And if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them at the coffee hour. Thank you.
Thank you, Renee, for a quite lovely offertory music, and thank you for supporting our Helping Hands fund, the charity, this week. So today I am introducing a returning speaker who we saw 2 weeks ago, Reverend Holly Horn, who will be helping us explore the place of food within our spiritual practices here at UUFM. 2 weeks ago, she gave us really powerful insights into the theological role of place and environment in our food through the eschatology of an Iowa pork tenderloin sandwich. Today, we take this exploration just a wee bit further, and I find convening this service particularly gratifying because, in part, it feels like it brings us full circle to a call for spiritual exploration of food that I made in a service a little over a year ago, if you remember that, where I gave a service that really explored the various meaning-making relationships we have to food and how we make them. As we prepare for Reverend Horn's talk, I want to remind you of one of the core themes of my talk last year. We continuously tell ourselves powerful stories that shape our identity through food. And in turn, these stories shape our connections to the soil, farmers, plants, animals, distribution systems, our bodies, gut bacteria, and eventually the organisms that decompose our waste. I spoke a bit about how food communities shape and rearrange our values around these stories, and they help us reimagine our own ethical and life practices. That's kind of the core of what I was trying to explore. And frequently in the United States, a omnipresent kind of corporate narrative of food seems to saturate our lives. For example, if you're watching the Super Bowl, Budweiser put out a commercial that's turned quite controversial, titled Brewed the Hard Way, last week. And you might recognize it's a very powerful and dangerous model of corporate food storytelling, right, that it provided. They deliberately privileged the kind of mass production of beer, not meant to be fussed over, and mass consumption of Budweiser's beer that encourages, first, cheap beer full of industrial ingredients like rice and corn that are produced in a problematic agricultural system degrading our environment. And second, overindulgence in the alcohol for alcohol's sake, which we know leads to degradation of health and the public, social, and economic spheres, right? Like, it's a really problematic message. But as we know, beer and food more generally is something that should be fussed over. Its implications on our human ecosystems are immense, from obesity-related health costs created by a system that encourages the poor to overeat cheap, sweet, and salty calories, to degradation of soils and ecologies that our children will never be able to recover. So the question is, how do we take on these food stories that permeate our culture yet degrade it? The craft beer industry had one answer to Budweiser. There's a number of satires, and if you go onto YouTube, they're actually quite funny. And some of the homebrewing communities actually produced beer kits that Budweiser was kind of playing down on, a peach pumpkin ale. So you can actually go and brew this now at home because Budweiser says it's ridiculous. And they're really highlighting the importance of fussing over our food. But that's only one industry reaching a small section of the population. We also need to think about how our local communities shape our everyday life practices through food stories, creating spaces and ethics that can either better or hurt humans, the billions of beings we coexist with in our environments. The question is, how do we brew the beer, grow the apple like Johnny Appleseed, or share a meal in such a way that it furthers our values and goals? Revan Holly will help us dive into inquiry today, exploring how Unitarian theological perspectives on food, community practices, and our choices help us create better stories that govern our lives. So, welcome.
Attending deeply to our bodies, to tastes and flavors, to aromas and textures, to foods which sustain us, give us great pleasure, and enhance the meanings of congregational life. The meals we share will no longer be a footnote to the real work of sitting and thinking. They will be an expression of religious values, a source of joy, a sacrament. I am describing here a religious practice that offers for us a new kind of sensory education, a different experience of what it means to be human, and not least because it entails our voluntarily relinquishing some measure of individual freedom in order to serve a greater good, communion with all life. Are there other ways to do this? Of course there are. One hopes that eventually our central religious practices, including Sunday morning liturgies, might enact an anthropology that disrupts what Bill McKibben refers to as hyper-individualism, our consumer culture, and supports practices of restraint, concrete expressions of communion with all life. The spiritual discipline of a menu engages us with a thick constellation of justice and sustainability issues, But it might also open up spaces of fasting and feasting, even reclaiming in some fashion the festive, what Victor Turner refers to as communitas, those moments of fusion, Charles Taylor writes, which wrench us out of the everyday and put us in contact with something beyond ourselves. Now, if this were to happen, it would be a very important development, not least because the central religious practices of our Unitarian Universalist youth, their sensory education, unlike our own, significantly overlaps with this powerful space of communitas. Many congregations already have some experience with countercultural food practices, a commitment to free trade coffee, offering a vegetarian or even a vegan option. Many participated in the UUA's Ethical Eating Congregational Study Program. So a baseline of awareness and information in our movement has been established. We have many resources for criticizing the principles we've lived by. We have many resources for creating a shared menu. David Grummet and Rachel Moores assert that the most pressing issue for a contemporary theology of food is how to reinstate reflection on diet into public discourse and inculcate an awareness that responsibility for dietary choices is societal as well as individual. They observe that present-day fear of public discussion about food practices seems to be motivated partly by a fear of passing judgments, being seen to pass judgments, or being judged. This may prove to be true for us too. Yet they assure us there is no obligation to agree with, share, or even not be revolted by what the other person does. The only obligation is to take seriously any attempt at eating as a spiritual practice and to refrain from what is often the instinctive first move, a suspicious or condemnatory interpretation motivated by a desire to buttress a sense of personal moral rectitude. Friends, we can do this. I do not know when the next hurricane will hit, when the next unexpected bout of extreme weather will wreak havoc with daily life, bringing misery and death. I do know that it is no longer a question of if, but when. Our best hope, our only hope, really, for mitigating the effects of climate change for future generations is to learn new practices of what it means to be human. It will require both public and personal commitments on many levels, shared food practices being only a modest first step. This is a profoundly theological task and an extremely difficult one. And friends, we must do this. May it be so. Amen.
So we're going to do a closing hymn, and then we'll have a brief discussion. So 131, Love Will Guide Us. So I'd like to open up the opportunity for kind of comments and discussion around this kind of compelling new narrative of food, right? Like, what if we told a story about our food and our menu to our community and made that a practice? And let's kind of start there and migrate in thoughts going around that. So go ahead and raise your hand if you're interested.
Christopher Renner. I'm teaching a course, by the way, on the culture and history of food in Italy this semester, so this is interesting to be talking about. One of the leading issues, though, whenever we talk about the implementation of fair trade, is that our current economic system does not provide for many of us, including myself, the financial means with which to buy that kind of produced food. I have to selectively choose what I can and cannot afford. And I think many of us here, I know quite a few people in this congregation, already have their own vegetable gardens or have a garden at the community gardens and engage in that kind of activity on their own. But then we get to this kind of season in Kansas where today it's 70 degrees, but wait, tomorrow it'll be 29 below zero. And we really have difficulty producing our own food. And so what do we do then? One of the statistics I throw out to my students is that in Italy, food travels a distance of 27 miles from production point to consumption point on average. In the United States, food travels 1,400 miles from production point to consumption point. That's a huge quantity of traveling that our food does in this country. But we really have to start looking at how can we, in places like Kansas, be able to produce food in the months of January, February, and March. And that's going to take the building of greenhouses and changing traditional agriculture as we know it in Kansas, of all places, the breadbasket of the country. So there's sort of two issues there. One is bringing about the larger change, and two, the economic justice change. Because when you start talking about working class people, they can't afford fair trade food. That's clear. I mean, they just can't. And the way our mass production of food is set up, the only way we can feed those people and pay them the $7.50 salary that they get is having this corporate agriculture model.
Yeah, so kind of note on terminology, fair trade usually implies very specific kind of brand of trade, right? And what we're thinking about holistic or series of practices and stuff, but yeah.
Bryce Hobrock, I think we have to realize how heavily subsidized agricultural production is in this country and in Europe and maybe other places in the world. Think how many people complain about the Department of Agriculture budget and the subsidies paid to farmers, $100 billion plus, et cetera. But what that does is ensure cheap and accessible food. And just an observation, if you go to a European grocery store and look at meat and other produce, you will be stunned at how small the portions are and how expensive it is. So we enjoy a rather superabundance in this country, and it's not to our benefit necessarily. Indulge me one bit further. I'm pleased that the young women and others at ECM are interested in gardening, but I just want to, and others have alluded to an earlier time when, gee, how do you really grow everything you eat? And I just want to say I'm old enough that I grew up in a time when we grew literally everything we ate. And the garden products, the meat, and the two-legged livestock, et cetera, the chickens, et cetera, we produced them all. And you spent your entire year preparing for the season when there would not be anything to eat. The root crops all went to the cellar to be dragged out in the depth of the winter. The beef, the pork, the chicken, the vegetables, the fruits, everything else went into glass jars that were stored in the cellar. And my mother's task of producing a meal simply said, okay, what do we have today? And she goes to the cellar, and it's all there all winter. And the only thing we really had to buy in town as necessities was sugar and flour and a few things like that. The Watkins guy came once a month with all these spices and potions. And so when you went to town in that time, why, you didn't go grocery shopping. You went to do trading, where you took the eggs you'd produced, the chickens you'd produced, you take them to the back door of the grocery store, and you get a certificate where they paid you for what you brought in. You walked around to the front door, and you traded in your scrip for things you couldn't produce on the farm. So my grandparents were homesteaders, and the food traditions we inherited came from that time. But how things have changed. And I know the young women's grandparents were 20th century folks who didn't experience that. I grew up with no central heat, no electricity, no running water, no indoor bathroom, and I don't want to go back there.
Yeah, there's a lot of... I think Bryce makes some really good points. There's a lot of compromises you have to make, right? Like, when do you celebrate with a meal, right? You can't just celebrate any time of year. It has to be in the fall or in the summer or the spring, right? This menu idea, I think, is really powerful in that it thinks about the land and the time and the space and very complicated questions.
Well, I'm only one person at this point in my life. I live alone. I live in a very small place. I have a very small rent. I have a very small income as well. I manage pretty well to live off almost completely locally grown, almost completely organic food. And it's just because I have arranged my life in that way, and my priority has not been that I need to have a large living space paying a high rent. Most people pay twice as much as I do that live in small apartments. I live in a small apartment that's half as much. So I can go to People's Grocery and I can get a CSA during the growing season, and hopefully sometime soon the CSA will go all year round, where I pay on a weekly basis, and I get a certain amount of locally grown organic produce. And that way I'm supporting the local food producers that are growing food in a way that's sustainable and helpful. And, so I know that it can be done because I'm doing it. I do admit that I'm only one person and I'm living a very unique lifestyle, but I think that we can all find a way if we really, really want to.
Well, and something that's been really nice for us entering into this community here is the network for food is so good. Like, people know Ronda Yonke, they know Parks right down the street, right? It's easy to acquire things in bulk. So I think there's ways to do it as a community too. Chris.
Chris Bailey, and my first job out of college was working for the Unitarians, but before that, what brought me to Washington, D.C. was an internship with the American Agriculture Movement. They were responsible for the tractorcades back in the 70s, if anybody remembers those. Their guiding light, their mission, this is before the days of mission statements, but what they were after was sustainable income for family farmers. And I am all for the family farm, for smaller farming, for producing things in the places where they are appropriate to be produced. But what Bryce was saying reminded me of a fairly common understanding in economic historians. Now, I'm not an economic historian. I'm a dilettante of history, but I have read in numerous places that before the modern age, before we had fossil fuel technology to industrialize our food production, 80% of the labor in society went to producing food, at best. This was, Europe after the Renaissance. It could get worse. So what we are talking about here is wholesale societal restructuring if we want to get to a place where our food is produced locally and not transported more than 20 miles or 100 miles from home. And we're probably looking at a lot more people having a lot fewer options, the individual not being as autonomous as we presently find ourselves. Just throwing that out there. There, I'll be back.
Just a quick sort of philosophical point here. The stress on the local community, I think, is a really positive one. But there's a danger in it, too, that's, for me, captured in a slogan that my daughter gave me on a T-shirt from Germany that said, "Germans, buy only German bananas." our sense of community can, and I think should, extend more broadly, and to some degree, maybe buying coffee from Costa Rica is a statement of friendship and community with Costa Rica, and this is important too. I wholeheartedly endorse the stuff that we've been saying about the importance of locality, in particular Chris's comment about an average of 1,400 miles. My gosh, the oil and gas that we use, the global warming we contribute to by doing that's bad. But let's just remember that we are part of the whole world, not just Kansas.
I think it's interesting, Sarah threw out a statistic when she was 2 weeks ago. We only produce about half of the fruits and vegetables in the U.S. that we need to meet USDA minimum amounts of consumption, daily consumption. So, this requires us really being creative and, indoor gardening and greenhouses and stuff.
Okay. First of all, I should preface my remarks. I'm Dave Lambert. With being very supportive of the idea of locally grown and organic produce. As many of you know, Sybil's a great community gardener, and I think we're still eating fruits and vegetables out of the garden. However, why the concentration on sustainability applied to food? Why don't we look at the other goods, such as auto travel, air travel, housing, shelter, food, clothing, that people spend 85 to 90% of their income on in this country. Why are we focused on food?
This is actually a really good question, and I might answer it if no one has a pressing. Well, yeah.
I guess you should probably answer first, because my piece that I've been raising my hand for is a little bit different.
Well, so we talked about the European income split on food. So before, about 60 years ago, 70 years ago, sir, just about, most families spent 30 to 40% of their income on food or food production, or 100, something like that. So there's a window that when we got fossil fuel fertilizers and pesticides and stuff and production scaled, all of a sudden the cost of food dropped because of the way policy is structured. And so we have these really big policy problems. And if food's an essential life. We should be spending on it like we're spending on housing, right? This is something that, we don't need travel, per se. We don't need these other things. So if you reemphasize the food, you have to budget out some of the other things, which in turn becomes kind of a trickle-down effect in your lifestyle. And the Europeans do this. They cut down the size of their apartment, or they don't have a car. But this is like larger structural policy too, you know. And but modeling it in food makes you ask other questions about the rest of your. That's the theory. we had a couple thoughts.
I was going to talk a little bit about subsidies because they were mentioned a few times. The agricultural subsidies were kind of started around the 1930s, initially as an idea to help family farms who were struggling through the Great Depression to survive, basically. However, I think statistically now about the majority of the subsidy money goes to about the largest 20% of farms that there are, which doesn't really work or make a whole lot of sense. You'd think that they would, that if we really wanted to support family farms, we would be giving the majority of it to the smallest 20%, those that were struggling or were having trouble getting by, because that is what the programs were kind of initially formed for.
Well, and most of the subsidies are applied to unedible foods, so like soy and corn, that field corn, not sweet corn, field corn, the stuff that you can't process. So it has to be converted industrially, and it just contributes to a. It's kind of like when you subsidize oil.
And there's the subsidy rules right now. There's only certain crops are eligible for it. So oftentimes farmers will only grow the crops that are on the subsidy or the insurance list, because if their crop fails and they pick something that was not covered or insured, then they are pretty much out of they pretty much just lost money for that year. So there's kind of a bit of a issue with that too, in the whole the way that the policy is structured.
So we don't have much more time for comments. It's the end of our service, but a great discussion. I'd like you to okay, one more. Alka will finish up.
Well, thank you. Since I still live between the cultures, I always defend both positions. I want to say that there is an adjustment. I can see it at Manhattan High School. When I first started working at the high school, I was appalled by the amount of food that was in the trash cans after lunch. I don't see that anymore. They have adjusted the portion size for breakfast and other meals that I think, my gosh, those kids need more to eat. That's the one thing. When we talk about Europe having a different outlook on food, it has a lot to do with the hard times that Europeans lived with over the centuries. But they are not as holy as we may think they are, because they spend their money. They live in small places. They produce more home-produced items, but they travel like crazy. And that is a very bad thing for the environment, and I am a traveler too, so I always feel guilty. But so each society has its strengths and weaknesses when it comes to all those things, and I think a lot of people are rethinking our practices at this time. Very late, but I think they are starting.
So thank you for all the great comments, and I'm going to end with some closing words, and we can continue to discuss in the coffee and afterwards. We share this planet not only with billions of fellow human beings, but also with uncounted billions upon billions of other creatures, with lives, wants, enjoyment, and suffering as real as our own. Humans have had and used the power to crowd them out, push them aside, sometimes drive them to extinction, and often making them into tools for our use, servitors of our desires, food for our tables, clothes for our backs. So with those thoughts, go forth and discuss.